Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Justin, your host for this episode. At the time of this recording, the Bitcoin block height is at 724,259, and the Bitcoin price in Australian dollars is 55,100. Today, I'm joined by Jeremy from hardblock.com.au, which is Australia's first and oldest Bitcoin-only exchange. Today's episode will focus on recent news from Canada, particularly about the risks of a potential Canadian bank run, as well as where Bitcoin fits in with what's going on over there. How's it going, Jeremy?
Yeah, pretty good. How are you, Justin?
Yeah, can't complain. Now, before we get into the current episode, have you heard the recent 2-Bit Idiots podcast with Hats and Brenda?
I've downloaded it, but I haven't quite listened to it. It's on my queue for tonight.
No worries. Well, they've cottoned on to the fact that we've launched our own podcast, and they've just covered this exact same topic. So I'm aware that we're at this crossroads where we either decide to collaborate with them or compete. And in the spirit of all things human, I vote that we crush them.
I don't know. Their guitar music's pretty good on their podcast.
They do have a good intro. They got Morpheus in theirs, and Hats is a very well-connected glove model. So all right, maybe we collaboratively compete with them, similar to what Bitcoin miners do or free open source software developers do.
That's definitely the right spirit.
All right, well, now we've got that sorted out, let's jump into it. So this potential of a Canadian bank run, I just want to talk a little bit about what actually happened and a bit of background as well. So most people are probably aware that there's some nonviolent protests in Canada's capital city of Ottawa. Now, we won't go into too much detail about what that's about, but the point is people are there protesting. And in response to that, the Canadian government has threatened to place financial sanctions on protesters, including freezing their bank accounts, confiscating money that's being donated to them, even freezing bank accounts of people that have donated. And so shortly after the government making those assertions, there was a spike in outage reports from customers of the top four Canadian banks. This was found on a website called Down Detector. And what they noticed was that Scotiabank, BMO, CIBC, and TD Canada Trust, which are the four top banks, they had this spike or this peak of outage reports. And so there was a public concern that there could be a bank run. And this bank run was in response to people thinking that their funds might be frozen. And it could have been the start of a bank run, but nothing catastrophic seems to have eventuated.
Yeah, so I mean, certainly I think it's important to separate the facts from the conjecture. Definitely the facts are there that those banks all at the same time had outages, which would be pretty scary if that was in Australia. Imagine the big four banks all going down at the same time and how people might react to that. I think fortunately for the people in Canada, and we've got a colleague there and I've got friends that are from Canada, that didn't turn into something chaotic. But you can see how that's the next logical step of the protesters if this is the response from the government.
True. And just for people listening in that might not be aware exactly what a bank run is, it's simply when enough of the population withdraws their money until the bank runs out of money supply, or sometimes called liquidity. And sometimes the question is, well, when would a bank run out? And it really depends. There's some reports that claim Canada only holds up to around 5% of reserves, which means if roughly 5% of the population's wealth is withdrawn from the bank is then unable to allow further withdrawals of the remaining 95%, unless, of course, the government steps in and bails them out, which usually requires them printing more money to do so.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, when people consider bank runs, they often wonder, how could something like this happen? And one phrase that you might hear a lot in this episode is fractional reserve banking. And what fractional reserve banking is something that all central banks and private banks around the world operate on, including Australia. The basic premise of a fractional reserve banking system is that most people are expected to be unlikely to withdraw all of their deposits at once. So banks generally think that they should be able to keep just enough cash in their reserves for liquidity purposes, while using the rest of the cash they have to fund things like new loans. I want to maybe just go into a bit more detail about that to clarify what I mean here. So most people think if they put a deposit into a bank, the bank would then lend that money out on almost a one-for-one ratio. What I mean by a one-for-one ratio, it's that the loan is backed or collateralized by the deposit, as well as whatever asset is being purchased with the loan, such as a house. So therefore, the loan is secured by the deposit and the asset. Therefore, any amount of people wanting to withdraw their deposits from the bank should be covered, as the bank will have enough necessary liquidity. However, how it really works is that you deposit money into a bank and the bank then lends out orders of magnitude more than the deposit amount, which effectively creates new money, but it also puts us into this fractional reserve banking scenario where there may not be enough liquidity if people try to withdraw their funds. Just as some specific facts about Canada. So in January 1929, Canada ceased redeeming the Dominion notes in gold. So initially their currency was backed by gold, but in 1929, they decided to move off the gold standard. Now, on top of that, the Bank of Canada, which is their central bank, has been selling their gold reserves over the years since then. They now hold no gold at all. And I mentioned earlier that their fractional reserves are estimated to be less than 5%. Australia, people might be thinking, is in a different scenario, but actually we're very similar to this. So our banks have only had a fractional reserve amount of around 0.5% and up to 2% for the last 20 years. However, since around the year 2020, we've had about 4.5% of fractional reserves. For anyone who's into trading, which I don't recommend, that's something like a 20 and up to 100 times leverage position. We've only got a small amount backing a very big play. And so what does this all mean? It means if enough people try to withdraw their deposits, the bank might not have enough supply to fulfill the withdrawals. There is a bit of nuance to this, and it's that loan money is also backed by assets too, not just the initial deposit. So for example, people might buy houses with their loan, and that house is then backing or collateralizing the loan. However, these assets can be quickly devalued in things like an economic crisis. Say for example, if people try to sell houses en masse, you would find a lot of that selling pressure would drive the prices of houses down, which means that there would be less backing of the loan from the asset. Plus, we already know that it's barely backed at all by the original deposit.
Yeah, so it's interesting when you look at a couple of things. Firstly, I looked at APRA, I'm not sure how you say it, which is the regulator of banks in Australia. And when you look at it from the bank's perspective, they actually talk about the fact that banks borrow their money from depositors. Whereas as customers, we don't see it that way. We just think we have a bank account and they help me do my transactions. But they are borrowing it, and they understand that that money has to be available instantly. And yet they loan it out on 30-year home loans. Mm. So they can't just instantly sell the house to fund your deposit because you've asked for it today. When you look through history of bank runs, what that actually meant was people queued up at the bank before it opened and got their cash out. What's going to happen today is what I think possibly happened in Canada, which is people went onto their bank account online and tried to take it out, maybe to a Bitcoin exchange, maybe to buy something else. And so the bank run is actually potentially a bandwidth issue at the bank initially, which possibly caused this outage. What that really means is that things can happen really fast. So like if there's a bank run where people are queuing up, they can only serve one person at a time. But in an internet banking world, the bank run could happen much, much faster than we've seen in previous times.
That's true. And it's one of those situations where sometimes just the concept or the idea that a bank run might occur creates this psychological situation where people might try to front run that and might try to withdraw their funds to remain safe. And that can actually then lead to a bank run essentially escalating, locking other people out. I want to just throw out an example here that I found a really interesting and pretty accurate way of looking at the way that fractional reserve banking system works. And it's from Guy Swan. He has this phrase, building houses with trees that we plan to cut down tomorrow. And so as a very practical example of how something like this might work, assuming that we have this less than 5% fractional reserve in, say, Canada's banks or Australia's banks, say if you go to your bank, let's just call that Bank A, and you deposit $100. Bank A then uses your $100 deposit to loan out $2,000. Let's just say they loan it out to someone who's doing some home maintenance work, and that person hires a plumber. The person pays that plumber $2,000 for their work. The plumber then deposits this into their own bank, Bank B. Bank B now takes this $2,000 deposit and they use it to lend out, which fundamentally creates around $40,000 to some other person or business. And this example can and does go on perpetually with increasingly larger absolute numbers of dollars lent out due to this multiplier effect. And interestingly, and probably shockingly, it all starts from this $100 deposit. You could probably consider this to be like a house of cards waiting to collapse if enough people down the line either default on their debt or try to withdraw the money from the bank.
Yeah, this is interesting because when you think about money printing, we're not printing money anymore, like literally at a printer. Most of the money supply is created with these loans from the banks, not from the Reserve Bank. So if you look at M1 money supply in Australia, which you can look up on the Fed side or the OECD side, it's growing at about 17% a year. And this is why, because all these loans are going out and houses are going up in value. So someone takes out more equity in their loan and they buy a car. And it just, that's where this is all coming from.
There's a really interesting point in Saifedean's The Fiat Standard, and he talks about how to mine Bitcoin or to create Bitcoin, you need to consume a lot of energy, and you need to put that energy through very specialized hardware that's trying to secure the network. However, he then states that fiat currency is mined, in quotations, through lending. So it's private banks and central banks lending either to the population or to government that essentially mines or creates new currency. I just thought that was an interesting way to look at it, and it shows that we're not really using that proof of work protocol. We're not really trying to sacrifice something to create something of value. We're simply willing it into existence through loans.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the current system incentivizes you to use loans because you can't save. They don't give you interest.
Exactly.
So why would you save and wait to buy something when you can just get a loan now at 2 or 3% interest?
Very true. And it's probably a good segue because a lot of people might be thinking, well, there must be some risk reward here. It's probably not as simple as just not having anything into the bank. If you ask me personally, I might actually say it is. However, let's look at some of the risk rewards here of holding money into a bank. I would say the reward would be the interest that you get on the deposit, which used to be something that was relatively substantial, whereas now the interest on deposits is relatively low, less than 1% in some cases.
In fact, the interest used to be higher than CPI. It could actually make real interest.
And it made sense. It was almost like an investment. You keep cash, so you put it in a bank to deposit, and you can earn interest on that. That keeps you ahead of inflation. That would have made a lot of sense. Some, rather than for the interest accruing purposes, keep the money in a bank because they feel some peace of mind from it. I would argue that's probably more of a perspective than a reality, though, given that from what's happening in Canada, we can see that, as someone put it really well on Twitter, your money in the bank is not your money. It's not in the bank, and it's also not money. So although people feel this peace of mind, keeping their money in the bank might be safer, we can see that there's a lot of risks to that, a lot of counterparty risk. Some people see that the government insures deposits, and that's where this peace of mind comes from. So in Australia, the government insures up to $250,000 of an account. This has implications, though. So if there is a bank run, or if there is a debt collapse because people can't pay their loans, although that money is insured, what needs to happen is the government needs to essentially create more money to be able to pay back, cover that insurance. Of course, by creating more money, we're increasing the debt bubble further. And we're also devaluing the existing currency as new currency is created to back those deposits.
You know, the situation that really arose, created this whole potential bank run was that the government was freezing accounts of certain citizens. So if you're relying on the government for your guarantee, it's not going to help you if you're, you know, being targeted by one of the government departments.
That's right. So, I mean, it comes with risks, doesn't it? You've got the inflation risk. You've got potential bank run risk. You've got a potential bank bail-in risk where perhaps either the bank freezes your funds to make sure they maintain liquidity, or, like you've just said, the government decides to freeze funds because they don't agree with the topic of protest.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't. I mean, they've always just put their money in the bank and they've never really thought about it. But from a risk-reward perspective, there is the potential to lose some or all of that money if there is a bank run. And the reward you get, we've talked about, there's no interest, basically. And in fact, some banks will charge you a monthly account fee. So you potentially are paying to use the service. And what you're getting is some convenience. So you've got an app and cards and so on, and you don't have to worry about securing it. But the price is that you could be risking potentially all of that money if you're last in for a bank run. So I think this is one of those situations where reading through history is really important to understand, okay, yes, in our lifetimes, we've never seen this. In a country like Australia, it's pretty shocking to see something even close to this in Canada. But reading through the history of banks, it makes it pretty clear that it's really not worth taking that risk for absolutely no reward.
Very true. And in the show notes, I'll post a link to quite a large list of bank runs. Some of them came to fruition and were an actual bank run, and some of them just looked like the beginnings of a bank run and caused some initial panic. However, I just want to rattle off a few examples for anyone who doesn't want to look to the show notes in that longer list. So since 2010, there's been about six. One was in 2011, and it was a rumor that spread via Twitter that the Swedish bank, Swedbank and SEB, which are two separate banks, were having problems. And that led to a belief that people wouldn't be able to withdraw their accounts. So they rushed to empty their accounts, which created essentially a bank run on those two banks, made it difficult for them to service other depositors trying to withdraw. I won't go through all the examples that have happened more recently, but just another couple to note. In 2014, the corporate commercial bank in Bulgaria essentially had the exact same thing happen. There was another bank run around 2015 in several Greek banks, and long queues were formed by people trying to withdraw their money who couldn't access it online.
I think the key word that you said in the first example is belief.
Exactly.
So currently people believe that their money is safe in the bank, and as soon as they stop believing it, there's a serious problem. And it's interesting when you look at the APRA document about liquidity, they're actually saying that while typical savings accounts may be withdrawn immediately, depositors do not usually withdraw all of their money at the same time. This mitigates funding liquidity risk. But they basically admit in there, if everyone does withdraw at the same time, the risk is not mitigated.
Exactly. There's a lot of trust in the banks. There's a lot of trust in the government who are supporting or insuring the banks. There's also a lot of trust in essentially the entirety of the population that no one, or at least no large group of people, gets the idea that this might happen. So what can you do to mitigate this risk?
Well, I actually think there's been a kind of a slow bank run already. So essentially, nearly everyone who's bought Bitcoin would have saved that money in cash in their bank account. Now they're saving in Bitcoin. So what that means is for the banks, they've actually got less deposits. And at the same time, many of those people, myself included, are looking to loans to pay for future expenses like, say, repairs on a house or to buy a car and so on. So both of those things actually make the situation worse. You're decreasing your deposits while increasing your loans. So if you play that out over, say, 10 years, effectively, I think what we're seeing is a slow bank run.
True.
Where the reserve ratio is just going to come under more and more pressure. But in terms of, I think, like day-to-day, like what can the average person do? Should you run to the bank and get everything out of the ATM? I don't think so. But starting to think about, for example, what people do in Argentina. So they're used to a dual currency system where they have their own local currency, which gets devalued. And they use US dollars to kind of save for longer term. And they're able to kind of think in both currencies and convert in their head. And I think we're kind of now at the point where most people should start thinking about doing that, maybe dollars in Bitcoin. So maybe you have enough dollars in your account that you can pay the next couple of months' expenses. You might make use of a credit card to have some credit just to kind of smooth out the flow of money going out of your bank. If you've got access to a home loan, maybe you just have that there in reserve in case something happens to your income, especially if you're like self-employed. And then your longer-term savings, you put away and save in Bitcoin because you know that, that can't be debased. But if you have it on your own hardware wallet, the bank can't touch it, the government can't touch it. No one can come and touch that. So it's a bit tricky because I haven't yet found a good way of saving for an expense that's, say, 6 months away because Bitcoin is so volatile. So you really can't use it for that purpose. But you can do a lot, especially if you do have a lot of savings in your bank account, in terms of just reducing that exposure to the bank. Another thing you can do is to try and smooth out like your outflows. You can sort of stream your payments out. So if you're paying like a quarterly council rate, you can stream that every week to them using BPAY, like a recurring payment. And that way you're kind of smoothing out the flows and making them more predictable in your account. So you can hold a lower amount in there. So there's definitely things you can do. And yeah, just, you know, trying to build that amount of savings in Bitcoin is obviously what's going to give you that sort of security in the future.
Absolutely. I think the really take-home point there is save in Bitcoin, spend in dollars, or save in hard money, spend in easy money. I know there are some that have moved to more of a Bitcoin standard where they save in Bitcoin and spend in Bitcoin. But as you mentioned, Jeremy, it comes with inherent risks. I wouldn't buy Bitcoin today for something that I expect to spend with it tomorrow or even next week or even potentially the month after that. However, I would buy Bitcoin today that I intend to spend on something in, say, years' time, because generally after holding Bitcoin for a couple of years, no one is complaining about the price movement. However, in the meantime, it's useful to recognize that it can be volatile, and therefore making sure that you secure yourself with enough cash to service your expenses, to service your outgoings, your bills, but then keep yourself enough savings in something that's hard and something that's self-custodied where you don't have counterparty risk of keeping it in a bank.
So I actually reckon the Commonwealth Bank can see this coming. And I think this is why they've actually allowed users to buy crypto in their app. Unfortunately, they offer Bitcoin and other ones. But you can't withdraw Bitcoin from the Commonwealth Bank app. So it remains an asset on their balance sheet.
Mm.
And so that helps them to, you know, improve their asset to loan ratio. And they're going to do that. It'll be convenient. You know, you can just do it within your app, within your one bank account. And I think they're kind of trying to defend themselves against potentially what they can see, which is there's now this alternative system where people can just withdraw their money and they're going to have this increasingly major problem. The other thing I think they're going to have challenges with is how do they actually attract depositors? It used to be the interest rates were the way that they attracted deposits. If you look at, I think the mortgage amount in Australia just passed GDP for the first time.
Mm.
So we cannot increase the loan interest rates. Therefore, we can't increase the deposit interest rates.
Yes.
So how are they going to actually attract people to deposit their salary into a bank account and keep it there? I'm not really sure. Maybe potentially they make it convenient to have Bitcoin.
That's right. The unfortunate part about that, it comes with the risk of, do we just start to then repeat fractional reserve banking with Bitcoin? If you trust, say, the Commonwealth Bank or another bank with your Bitcoin, will they have something in place that stops them then loaning that out to other people, or by loaning that out in dollars, say, and backing it with the Bitcoin asset? Which is why our perspective is always to hold your own Bitcoin, to buy it on a trustworthy exchange, but then to withdraw it into a cold storage or a hardware wallet. And if you use Bitcoin for spending, put that in a Lightning wallet, perhaps. But I guess the point is, don't trust a third party to not reuse your funds or to not use a fractional reserve system.
Yeah, and there's just no reason to take that risk. You know, if you time it right, if you look at mempool space when it's quiet, you can do transactions for about 11 cents.
Absolutely.
So why would you take the risk? Even if you have to move it back again later on and you've lost another 10 cents, it doesn't matter because you've protected yourself. I think some people on the other exchanges where they're paying $20, $30 for a transaction, they're loath to have to take on that transaction cost. But if you do just use the normal Bitcoin transaction network fee, it's actually very cheap at the moment.
So we could probably say, even though it's cliche, it's pretty accurate to say that Bitcoin fixes this, or at least it's perhaps on the way to providing a fix for this for the people that decide to adopt it.
Yeah, I think it fixes it for the people. It breaks a lot of stuff for the banks.
Absolutely. Very true. So there's a final point here that I want to just explain a little bit, not so much about the bank run, but about the fundraising activities that were happening in Canada around these protests, because Bitcoin has a bit of a link in here as well. So just to give a little bit of background, GoFundMe was initially used to raise around $10 million for the protesters. Now, GoFundMe ended up freezing these accounts, and I understand that they're now sending that back to all the users, but there's a bit of a delay. And so users then, people who wanted to donate, that is, decided to move to GiveSendGo, which is a GoFundMe alternative. And it was believed that GiveSendGo would be more of an independent intermediary and there would be less counterparty risk. However, unfortunately, the numbers vary, but it looks like another up to $5 to $10 million was frozen from donators who donated to GiveSendGo. So the exact same thing happened. Unfortunately, it gets a bit more complicated than that too. So while funds were still being raised, around 1,000 donors' ID details, so either passports or driver's licenses, were leaked because they were stored on an unencrypted server, which was linked in the webpage source code. So someone went to the GiveSendGo website, went view source, found this web address, went to the web address, and there was around 1,000 donor ID details, which they then leaked. Unfortunately, it gets worse than that. A little bit afterwards, after GiveSendGo decided to freeze user funds, a hacker managed to get all of the donors. This was several thousand donors that they then leaked publicly and leaked back to the Canadian government to allow them to freeze those users' bank accounts or in place some sort of financial sanctions. So while this was all happening, a few prominent Bitcoiners, BTC Sessions, Greg Foss, and Jeff Booth, set up a donation crowdfunding related specifically to Bitcoin through a platform called Tallycoin, which is actually developed by an Australian developer named DJ Booth. And so the idea here is that it was a multi-sig contract, which let Jeff Booth, Greg Foss, and BTC Sessions have a joint responsibility for these funds. They raised over 21 Bitcoin. They then distributed those funds to the protest liaison, who's Twitter name is Nobody Caribou, who then distributed those funds to protesters. And now there has been some reports that the Canadian government is going to try to freeze those funds As we know, you can't freeze a Bitcoin address or a Bitcoin UTXO. They might try to freeze the off-ramps to stop them withdrawing it in cash. However, there are ways that the protesters might move around that by remaining in Bitcoin or spending in Bitcoin. It's not too important what they do with it. I guess the point here is that Bitcoin provided an option for donators to raise and crowdfund donations to protesters and remove either expensive or potentially compromisable intermediaries like Give, Send, Go and GoFundMe. And they did it in a way that protected users' identity information as well. So nothing was able to be leaked like it was with the Give, Send, Go website. Another point where Bitcoin might fix this, or at least it's on the way to fixing it.
Yeah, I mean, that Give, Send, Go, the fact that the user's information was leaked is actually very scary if you live in Canada, because if you look at the wording of the emergency legislation, it applies to anyone who's involved with the protest. So you could make an argument that these people who donated were involved, and therefore if they're Canadian residents, potentially they could be subject to the emergency legislation and have their bank accounts frozen just for making a donation. But I've got a question for you. Do you think if you make a Lightning payment to the donation, do you feel that that's private enough?
It depends who's looking. So when it comes to privacy, it's always useful to think about your threat model. Your threat model being, who are you trying to remain private from? Generally speaking, Lightning is not private. There is a really good article that explains this in some highly technical detail, but also with some summary take-home points, which I'll link in the show notes. But essentially, Lightning is still able to be traced, especially if there is an entity with enough rigor or scrutiny. And I would say that a government, a state body, an intelligence agency would definitely have that kind of rigor or scrutiny to be able to undo the privacy that people think they gain through Lightning transactions. The other point here is that most people, when using Lightning, are using a custodial service, which means essentially they're trusting an intermediary with their data, with the details of that transaction. The alternative would be to run your own Lightning node, which would give you some level of additional privacy. However, that can still be scrutinized, unfortunately, at this point at least, to then undo some of the privacy that's believed to be gained by using Lightning. There is a lot that's being worked on in this space. So Lightning is not yet private, but I would expect that it would become more private over time. There are also things that users can do to mitigate this, such as using, rather than a Lightning transaction, they might use an on-chain transaction, like a coin join, to provide themselves some additional privacy. And then they might set up a Lightning channel or create a Lightning transaction.
So it is at least possible. I guess that the key takeaway for me, I think, is that at least if you've used Bitcoin or Lightning, it's not a centralized list of everyone. Whereas with Give, Send, Go, they've just from one centralized source got the list from everyone. That there's no more work to do. Whereas if you've used Lightning or Bitcoin, and you know, some people are only sending a few dollars, each of those people needs to be investigated. And that's a significant amount more resources than just, you know, sending a subpoena to one company in Canada, say.
Absolutely. You'd say it's more private than entrusting a central authority like a bank or a Give, Send, Go with all of those details of transactions and identification.
One thing we didn't cover is that if you look at what the banks are forced to hold, so they hold cash so that you can withdraw it out, but they actually don't hold it in cash form. I mean, it's not cash anymore these days, but a lot of the, a significant portion, I believe, of the cash assets are bonds, short-term bonds, 3-month bonds. So if there was a bank run, they would be forced to sell some of those. That's the only thing they really could sell. They can't just go and sell houses. So they'd have to sell their 3-month bonds, which I think would probably force the government to either buy them or let the short-term interest rates go up.
That's true.
So, you know, it's more far-reaching than just your bank. It's potentially the whole currency that could be impacted.
It's one of those examples where it shows the second order effects of things can sometimes be much more drastic and longer lasting than just the initial point of not being able to withdraw a deposit.
Definitely. Now, I have to say, this stuff is pretty complicated. I did have a look at the Commonwealth Bank annual report to try and get some information. But if you are listening and you have an expertise in banking in Australia, let us know. We'd love to hear a technical opinion on how this all actually works.
Absolutely. And if there's any other mitigating strategies of how to protect yourself from something like a bank run, we'd love to hear those sort of things too.
For sure. Yeah, because I certainly haven't solved the short-term issue. I'd love it if Bitcoin wasn't so volatile.
Agreed. Although every year is Bitcoin's least volatile year. It's decreasing gradually over time. And as I've heard it put, volatility is inversely related to market cap. So the more Bitcoin grows, the less volatile it becomes.
I think one probably final takeaway that I think is worth sharing that when things are not urgent, it's sort of hard to have the kind of emotional drive to make these changes, which are inconvenient. But I'd say just if you do think it's a concern, just do one thing this week to get yourself in the right direction. Maybe it's just setting up a Bitcoin account or buying a hardware wallet or watching a video about it. Just do one thing to try and get yourself on the path. Because I really hope, and I don't think there'll be a bank run this week.
Yes.
But I think there'll be a slow worsening of the situation over the next years and maybe over the decade.
True. And a good mindset with these sort of things is don't let perfect be the enemy of good. If you feel there is some benefit to doing this, don't think that it needs to be an on or off switch. It's more like a dial or a spectrum where there's small things you can be doing today to become more familiar, to secure yourself better. And over time, that becomes easier to increase as you get more familiar with it.
Definitely.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Please like, share, and subscribe if you enjoyed the content. And let us know in the comments or reach out to us on Twitter if you have any sort of feedback or content requests. Or, of course, if you're an expert in this area and want to give us a more technical rundown of how this all works. Our Twitter handle is HardBlockBTC. That's all one word, HardBlockBTC. Thanks for listening, and until next time.